Hey there, you're welcome to Founders Connect, a show where I have conversations with amazing entrepreneurs and operators in Africa. This is the right show for you to be listening to if you love behind-the-scenes stories about people, their careers, and all their businesses. My name is PC Timmy, and I'm very, very, very delighted to be your host. You can follow this conversation on social media, hashtag Founders Connect. You can watch the video of each episode on my YouTube channel at PC Timmy, or just search for Founders Connect on YouTube to find the playlist. Also, please share this podcast, subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, leave a rating, and you know, share it, hashtag Founders Connect. Enjoy the episode. Today, I'm having a conversation with someone I've been pursuing since forever.
Yeah.
Because, like, it has to happen, and it finally is. So I'm really excited. Her name is Adia, and she's the current CMO of MTN Nigeria. Let me say that again. Current CMO of MTN Nigeria. And she was also the former CEO of Tribe Greek, and many more things we're going to find out in this interview. So make sure you stay and watch, grab a popcorn, grab a drink, because it's going to be really interesting, I'm pretty sure. So let's do this, guys. See you after this video. Hi, Adia.
Hi, peace.
How are you doing today?
I'm great.
You look really great.
Thank you.
So the way I like to start interviews is, I really want to know about you. That's really what Founders Connect is. It's like, it's not really about the, oh, your current CMO. We'll get there, but it's like, who is this person, right? So we'll start from your background. Like, where did you grow up? What schools did you go to? Anything you can tell me about just growing up as a child.
How far back do you want to go?
If you can remember how you came out. we can start from there.
I actually do, but I'm not going to out my mother.
You actually do! That's a first.
Oh, I know the story.
Okay.
And I know the story because it led to my name. So I was a C-section baby.
Oh.
The first C-section baby in my entire family. And by that, my grandfather gave me my name, which essentially captured how he felt at the time. And he was like, oh, okay, babies come out of there. You know, and my name means as you grow old, you see spectacular, miraculous things.
Mm.
So yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to live up to.
Obviously, it's working. It gets better.
Yeah. So I like to give people a show, you know. So yeah, that's how I started, since you asked. I was born in Surulere.
Oh, so you grew up in Lagos?
Oh, of course, I grew up in Lagos. Yeah, lots of people don't, like...
You don't really look
at me. They look at me, they don't like, they see me eating starch and banga with my hand or like Amala, and they're like, uh-uh. I'm like, yeah. But yeah, I was born in Surulere, grew up in Apapa for most of my life. Primary school, Corona, secondary school, Nigerian Navy, secondary school. Was blessed to go abroad after that.
Do you have a favorite memory as a child?
No, God, no.
Too many?
Too many. I can't do that. I try not to give. I just enjoy any moment as it comes. Like, that's too hard.
So there's nothing that sticks out. Like, oh, I really am fond of them.
No, I think one thing I have that that has become more precious to me as I've grown up is my family.
Mm.
So I have a really large extended family. My parents have 13 siblings apiece.
A piece.
So I have cousins, uncles, aunties, you know, out the wazoo. For every habit, hobby, endeavor, I have a family member that I share, you know, strong memories with. You know, I have an uncle that taught me to draw. I have an uncle I climbed trees with, one I rode bicycles with, you know, one I watched documentaries with, one I watched tennis with. So I have that. I have three brothers, yes. And many surrogate brothers and sisters, right? So I think growing up with that imbued me with a lot of confidence that I did not really understand or value until I became an adult. Like I would enter meetings with Google and Facebook and literally be like the only person on my side. And then I'd be talking to like 8 guys at Google or 12 people from Facebook. And on a couple of occasions, like a couple of the guys would come up to me and be like, you handled yourself, Sha. Like, there were so many of us in this room, and we, you know, like, we didn't expect that you'd just be, you know, confident. And I didn't understand it, and I can't remember what I was doing one day, and it just hit me that I grew up, you know, walking into rooms full of people much bigger than me. Like,
right.
My uncles, my aunts, my cousins, all of that legacy. That was Tuesday. Mm. Do you understand? That was dinner. That was, you know, randomness for me. So walking into rooms like that is not...
And just showing up by yourself.
It's normal. Do you understand? Right. I'm at home, you know? So I can't enter a room like that and be scared. Mm. You know what I mean? So that's not to say I'm never scared, but that scenario doesn't scare me. And then I realize how that has patterned me and my confidence, right, when I'm in rooms even as an adult. So that's definitely... So it's not one memory, yeah, but it's one part of my childhood that I hold really, really, really dear. Yeah.
It's very interesting. Thank you. You said dropping it hot. Okay, let's let's go to school. So when you left secondary school, yeah. You went to uni. What country did you go to and what did you study?
So, yeah, after many discussions with my father, and I think there was some randomness happening in the US at the time, which is kind of similar to what's happening now. Mm. He was like, yeah, no, that America is not, it's not going to work. So I went to UK. I went to the University of Sheffield and studied electronic and electrical engineering, which was simply because I couldn't quite connect with all the other disciplines. So I guess maybe I hated the rest and I just thought, okay, I don't really know. Electrical, double E doesn't seem like it's going to focus me or put me in any box that I'm uncomfortable with. It looks like there are many places I could go. It felt freeing, so I did it. Probably 2/3 of my class didn't make it to the end of the course, right? So I did that, and then after that, England was kind of tough for me at the time. I think personally, you know, for my family, so I really just wanted to put it behind me and go somewhere else. So went to the States, and then I was applying for jobs and applying for masters and getting a lot of no's at the time. This was like right after the dot-com bubble, right. You know, and you know, the CNN ticker tape would say, okay, 5,000 laid off, 10,000 laid off, right? So it was a very strange time to be in the States. So hustle, hustle, hustle. I found a job with a telco there in a state called Iowa, which many of us know now. or we know during election time in the US.
Yes,
right?
I know it's
very special. But yeah, that's where I got my first job. And then I realized that there's almost nobody there between the ages of 18 and 30. Right? So stayed there for a couple of years and then found another job in Chicago.
Yeah.
Same company, but I just transferred over. So hung out there for a little while. And then I realized, so when I started as an engineer, I used to design wireless networks. So basically the network that speaks to your mobile phone. Mm. I was the designer using AI all the way.
So you were
there.
Actually doing engineering at that
yes,
time?
Yes, ma'am. I was an engineer for six, 7 years. All right, so I was the design engineer that designed what the network would look like. So basically, if your phone didn't work, it would eventually get to me,
yeah.
And I would fill in the coverage gaps. So I did that. My first network was an AMPS network, which these days you would look at as a 1G network. That was like the first
1G.
First generation network. So I had an AMPS network, and then I had a 2G network overlaid. So I did 3G training. Overlaid the 3G network, and it was in 4G training, and this was in like, I don't know, 03, 04. I was like, yeah, this is the same exact problem that I'm solving. So, but right. The technology was changing, but it was the same exact problem. And I realized, okay, I wanted to do something else. I wanted to solve more problems. I wanted that freedom, that same freedom I was looking for with the double E. I wanted it again. So I applied to for a master's in engineering and an MBA at the same time. Although the MBA deadline came up first, and then I was like, okay, this seems like it'll be fun. And then coming from the family that I came from, I started from number one and two school first, and I said, let those ones reject me before we now go lower, because everybody was like, hey, you can just enter here. It's like pancake school, tertiary school, not doing that. You know what I mean? This again is the kind of confidence that my family imbued with me. Start at the top. Then, you know,
see where you land.
Then see how far, you know. So I got into both Kellogg and Chicago. I went to Kellogg. And that was a very sort of, from the very first class, my mind just started opening.
And how so?
It's just my understanding of my environment and what was going on around me. I think it was like a case study on Coca-Cola branding and Father Christmas be red and white. And I was like, my God, what have these people been doing to me? you know, I can't remember exactly what it was, but I just felt my mind expanding. So yeah, that was fun. After that, went into management consulting for a couple of years.
That was at Deloitte.
Yes, at Deloitte in Chicago. That was also many teaching moments in that.
Is there one that sticks out?
Oh, I know what bitterness tastes like exactly.
Oh wow!
Like it is like.
I didn't see that coming.
Algae and green is just horrible. Okay, I'll tell you why. So sometimes your route forward is not exactly a straight one. That incline is not. Sometimes you take a couple steps back to go forward, right? So, so I went to business school part time. So that was quite a struggle, and because of that, it was tough to fashion out the typical leave your job, go to business school for 2 years,
and then
come out, and your next job you'll be making 50% more. It wasn't quite that similar for me. Oh, it wasn't quite the same for me because I already had a job, so I couldn't quite participate in recruiting in the same way. So when I was now ready to move, it was not as much of a jump as I wanted it to be. So I say I know the taste of bitterness because one of the things you do to prepare for management consulting interviews is called case interviewing. And I was case interviewing with other people who took a different route, some of whom were in the full-time program, right? So those ones who now come into consulting, they now ended up in the level above me because I sort of was hired as an experienced hire, even though I had an MBA. Right, but they kind of followed the conventional MBA.
And so they got the
So they got the bump. So when I would see them and then they'd be like, oh, that thing you said to me, it was so valuable and it really made me successful in this interview. I was like, wow. Do you understand?
Yeah.
But, you know, the taste is temporary and we're all doing, you know, well now. But the lessons I took from that job definitely supported me 2, 3, 4 jobs. After that. So
you left Deloitte and then that was the next one became Etisalat.
Yes.
So what made you move from the US back to Nigeria?
The recession, baby. So the States in 2008-2009 was a pretty tough place to be. So I remember recruiters telling me VPs were getting manager jobs, right? Mm. So lots and lots of people were losing their jobs. So it was very hard to stay employed. You know, Wall Street fell. I mean, like whole companies, like Bear Stearns, there was just that crisis was insane. There just seemed to be a lot of discussion and activity around Nigeria. So I put all my stuff in storage and I said, let me give it a try. It was hard because it was unknown for me. I left Nigeria at 16. So I hadn't really experienced adulthood.
And when you came back, you were how old?
30.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I hadn't experienced adulthood in Nigeria at all. I had found my independence and my individuality as an adult, you know, while I was away. And moving back to Nigeria meant I would have had to move back in with my parents. I didn't have a source of income. I mean, remote work exists now, but that didn't exist then. Sure. You know what I mean? So like, I was like, how am I going to survive here? You know, and I just didn't know. Being the Virgo that I am, there was no certainty. So that made me made me quite anxious. You know, but I came back and I can't complain about the results, you know, at least not now.
Obviously.
I mean, it worked out. It worked out. I mean, it took some doing, but I guess this is that, you know, grit that Nigerians are famous for, right? Mm. So I just kept trying till I got what I want.
What you wanted was to work in telecoms, or did it still just happen by chance?
Yes. So that's a funny story. So I wanted to be properly valued. I could have gotten a job in a bank. My first offer when I got here was pretty low. It was like a 4 million naira salary offer, and I was like, okay,
4 million a year.
Yes.
Okay.
I said no. I'm looking for like 20 million. Thank you. I mean, I appreciate the offer, but not what I want. But I started to understand that. Look, if you go looking for a job just to get a job, rather than go looking for a job that values the skills that you have, that's when you start to get, you know, offers like that. So while I will eternally be grateful for even that offer. I had to sort of stick it out to get what I want. So at the time, This was well before you could get a CEO's email address easily. All right, so I had to figure out the CEO of Etisalat's email address because I tried to get into all the other telcos. Ironically, MTN bounced me. Like, they didn't allow me. I didn't even have a conversation with MTN. I know the person that bounced me then, and I've met her again.
Hey,
and
look at me now.
No, I haven't even pointed it out to her. I'm trying to be kind. So I came up with 13 different versions of the CEO's email address because I had his name, which is Stephen Evans. So I did Stephen.Evans, Stephen with a V, a P, H, and F, Stephen _, Stephen _,
S, his surname.
13, S dot, yes. I came up with 13. And I remember sending that email and then watching the bounce backs just, and I counted. And I said, well, one didn't come back. So let's now see whether he will answer that one. And a day later, he did. Very fast. And basically, of course, I sent it the email and I said, hey, okay, this is great. This is who I am. You know, and I'd like to come talk about the industry. Yemu, my CV was attached, of course, right? So I think it was. If it wasn't attached, it was attached by the second email. And whether he asked for it or not, it was there.
I mean, that was the point.
That was the point, but of course I couldn't, you know, I had to try and be sly. But the guy was hip to my game and was like, oh yeah, come, let's just. And what I thought would be a 20-minute conversation ended up being a 2-hour grilling. And the first of 8 interviews I had with Etisalat, 3 with him, because he was quite particular and wanted to be sure that we would have a good working chemistry, you know. So of course I shook him down about it as soon as I got there. I'm like, Ogbeni, what was that? Like, why did it have to be so? And he was like, oh yeah, sorry. Then he explained why he needed to make sure that we worked well together. So yeah, that's Etisalat was the job after that. And then I had a bunch of different roles at Etisalat. So first a strategy role, then I started managing a P&L, which is a whole different vibe, you know, from doing a lot of thinking and planning and sort of managing execution to like counting dollars and cents. It's very different.
Do you think that your time at the US Cellular, that was the telecoms you worked in the US as an engineer, contributed to like the success you had at Etisalat?
So yes, definitely. And to be fair, that's what happens in your career. There is a lesson to be taken from every single job you've had. The question is whether is how present that lesson is to you and whether you can see it. So because I was an engineer designing the network, I was very familiar with towers where you put the antennas. My job was design the antenna design, right? Selecting which tower to use. So I'd liaised with tower companies indirectly. So one of the first set of deals I did when I came here, because I was head of strategy and business development was sort of like the partnership side, large scale partnerships that help move the needle, right, for the company forward, whether the cost needle or the revenue needle. So one of the first set of partnerships I did was the tower partnerships. I was working with the likes of Helios and IHS and all the new tower companies at the time. So that is a direct, you know, the only reason I could do that so easily was because of the type of engineer that I was at US Cellular. So all of those infrastructure partnerships were not difficult for me to understand because I had that technical background.
That makes sense. So, I mean, like you said earlier, you moved different roles. You went from business to head of media, then digital business. That was like strategy, business, and then marketing, Was moving the roles the reason why you spent that long on Etisalat, almost 8 years? And then what was the reason why you moved at different points in the company?
So let's just say it helped, right? Because it kept things challenging and fresh for me. I wouldn't have been able to spend 8 years doing the same job. I don't think I've spent 8 years doing the same job anywhere.
Ever. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's usually 2 to 3 years and then I'm looking for, you know, the next challenge, right? So yeah, it kind of added up. But like I said, I mean, I had 3 pretty significant jobs while I was there. So, and the scope always changed or grew in a challenging way where, you know, I was able to stay.
So did you say, oh, I see this department, they have a need, I want to move there? Or the company like, you know, Adi, I think you've done great here, but we need your help here. How did the move happen?
It's a little bit of both. It depends on the role, right? So it's a little bit of both. So I think by the time I'd spent all that time in strategy, you know, I was talking to my boss. I'm like, okay, what's next? Like, do I move up? Yeah. And then he now said, I want to move you to this other department. Right. Which, to be honest, in the first instance, I didn't quite like, because it was a horizontal change. You know what I mean? And I was looking for upward movement. But then that also taught me that, look, you can't change too many things at once. You can't move up and into a new department at the same time. That's too many challenges at once. But what I did know how to do was lead a team at a particular level. But the lateral move was just changing the subject matter or the content of what I was leading. But I understood how to lead a team towards getting results. So if I had tried to lead at a higher level and change the context, that actually probably would have been too much. And I've seen a few people fail at doing that, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to be careful, how many dimensions you are changing when you're looking for a promotion. So initially, it was not what I wanted. It wasn't what I expected. So it took me a couple of weeks to just sort of internalize the change. I got some advice. I still remember the people that were most excited about the role and said, look, you should do it. So I did it. And I got there and I was like, you know what? You're right. It was a different area. It was a growing area within the telco space. So I had to sort of like quickly get smart about it and then, start achieving and then significantly grow that business,
right?
Because the goal when you sort of start as a small unit, like your small startup inside the telco, is you wanna make it bigger. Which I was given the space and opportunity to do. Right. Yeah. So as the business got bigger, then the whole department and the mandate got a little bit bigger. And then somewhere along the line, I picked up financial services, right? And things just grew from there.
What are the two things you're most proud of from your time at Etisalat?
My God. Again, you're trying to make me choose. I don't know if I'm going to be able to help you with an answer to the question.
Hey, just say the ones that come to your mind. You don't have to be like the top two. Just...
Let me try and answer that by talking about what had the most impact on me. I learned a lot about partnerships and doing deals in this environment, right? Which is, the difference between win-lose and win-win and why win-win is better and how to find a win-win. It might take a little bit of work, but win-win arguments, they last longer. Just understanding that trust is a critical ingredient to partnership and how those dynamics are very different because we work in a low-trust, low data, low infrastructure environment.
Low everything.
Right? So these are the things that frustrate partnership. But in a fragmented market like this, where scale is very difficult to achieve on your own, you have to scale with partners. I found a very sort of deep understanding of the things that help and support partnerships and the things that we do that naturally just make partnerships hard. So that's one. Two, I think the opportunity to work with startups, again, opened up like a whole new career direction for me, and just connecting with that dynamism and energy and innovation and supporting it. I think those were sort of like two major things that affected me. Yeah.
Okay. And so just talking about the last one, startups, that's where you now went to Baby Migo and ended up doing Travel Greek, right? So
yeah,
let's talk about that.
Yeah. Migo, I mean, rather. It was so there was a name change in the company. And again, I was getting to that 3-year mark and asking myself, okay, what else do I want to do in the telco? And I kind of run out of thoughts or opportunities. And then by that time, I had spoken to startups a lot and given them a lot of advice on what I thought they should do. No, I mean, some took it, they scaled, some didn't, they didn't, right? But I thought it might be good if I could take my own medicine. Mm. So, I had a good rapport with the Migo team. So I joined to take Migo out of pilot stage and into the real world and build a team in Nigeria and shape the product for growth globally. So... yeah, that was the Migo.
How was the experience like? How was Migo different from what you had done at Etisalat and the other companies you worked with?
Completely insane now. I mean, I think one of the things you understand very quickly when you're leading a startup is how exhausting context switching is. And when I say context switching, I mean it's just the sheer number of things your mind can be working on at the exact same time, right? And nobody really gets that. That's where exhaustion comes from. Like, it's one of those silent things that you just do, and then you don't understand why you're tired at the end of the day. But if you start off, you know, you're thinking about hiring, then you go to business development, then you go to operations, then you go to technical support, then you go to your website design, then the generator spoils, then you now start looking for another office. So it's like literally your mind is cycling through all of these things constantly throughout the day. And these are, I've become an expert in exhaustion. So these are the things that actually add up. So you know, Migo, I mean, I was like a wrung out towel. Like I did everything, just like completely submitted myself to the chaos. You know, but it was fun and I learned so much. I learned how to, you know, build a company from the ground up, rebuild it, take it down, you know, like see what's working, break it apart. Like it was just
was the biggest lesson. I like, yeah, if I forget every other thing about my Migo experience, this lesson, like
I don't forget anything. I learned how to build native to an environment. Like really, really native. I think lots of people, and I get frustrated on people's behalf when you just sort of photocopy a business model and assume that it's going to work. It's just not going to work if you don't understand the context in which that product has to thrive, in which that product has to find a user, in which that product has to find millions of users. Yeah. You know, remember what I said just now about low trust, low data, low infrastructure. Lots of people go and take a product they've seen somewhere on TechCrunch and try to replicate it in Nigeria, but it just won't work because we have different infrastructure, and I mean different identity infrastructure, physical infrastructure, financial infrastructure, education infrastructure, like all of that is lacking, or it's in a different place, I should say, right? You don't have enough infrastructure to even keep a contract together. You know what I mean? So it's almost like the weight of a contract in an emerging market is very different from, you know, a developed market, right? Because you just don't have the police or the legal system, right, to support that engagement. So what that means is, as Nigerians, you have to examine the person you are dealing with so much more, right, to be sure that you're going to get what it is you're putting in that contract, right? And then there's also very little data, because very little is measured or digitized.
Right.
Even what is digitized, everybody keeps relying on everyone else to do the digitizing without understanding the role each of us plays in potentially capturing and creating data. Now, someone else, of course, will have to aggregate it, but that's a whole other story. So the way you build a product in an environment that is subject to those types of circumstances, then add, you know, VUCA stoves. You know, it's different. You design products completely differently.
So how did you guys design and build Migo then?
Okay, so, I mean, gosh, the brilliance was done before I got there. So I can't really take too much credit for it. But so the difference between, you know, Migo and many other lending products, first of all, Migo is available on USSD. First. You know what I mean? So the fact that it's available there, everybody's chilling on Android, already creates the opportunity for scale. Then the way the product flow is designed, it relies on getting critical data in order to build trust of the user coming to ask for money without asking the user. You know what I mean? It's like you doing research on somebody before they enter the room. Because if you're there, like, what's your name? Where did you go to school? Where do I know you from? How can I trust you? You are already, if your trust started here, each question is...
Yeah.
Because questions are very emotional. They elicit an emotional response, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
But at Migo, we managed to stay close to, like, a good trust starting point because APIs called all the critical information we needed because they were tied to the phone number. So what that does is it changes the sequence of your conversation with the customer in the product. You know what I mean? We were able to say, okay, we can give you a loan of 5,000 naira right now. And the only question we're asking you is, which account should we send it to? That's not a question that gets a negative emotional response in Nigeria. It gets a positive emotional response.
Yeah.
So basically, we structured that flow for joy, right? All the hard questions were taken care of by the APIs. Now, even if we didn't have all the information, we'd say, okay, we can give you a loan for 10K. But we need you to just add your BVN and then we'll put it into your account right away. And then we delivered on that prop. So when we said right away, we didn't mean next week or later today. We meant 60 seconds from now, that money will be on your account. So what that did is it you now have a product that is designed for talkability, and talkability leads to virality. So I can tell you that at no point in time was I ever to account for more than 10% of the marketing. I didn't know where most of the customers were coming from directly.
Right.
Indirectly, you could see there was probably a conversation, some proximity, some sort of demography, which meant that people in certain areas were talking about this product. Right. So building that process, right, was us taking the process of lending someone money, breaking it down, and redesigning it for the context that we live in, right? And then, I mean, now it's become quite the standard, right? Even though some things are not well understood and overused and poorly used in some cases, right? But you see what I mean. So that's, I think, what Migo really got right. And of course, myself and one of the founders, Ikechi, we spent many hours, you know, just like talking about the different iterations. So we would discuss 100 things and then maybe one would make it into the flow or become the next sort of product in the roadmap, right? But just going through that process over and over and over again helped me really understand.
I feel like I just did a small masterclass in product growth.
I am a whole masterclass every minute of the day, don't worry.
That's amazing. I mean, we've talked a bit about from Itala to Migo and just the successes, right? Like, kind of things that you've done.
Mm.
Tell me about the mistakes you've made along the way.
Oh, things. I made a ton. I make mistakes every day.
Yeah.
I think not taking care of myself. Mm. Right? It's just sort of thinking that you are invincible and the energy is infinite. That's always a mistake. But I've always worked hard and always sort of believed in what I did. I've always learned constantly. I think not loving failure early enough. I think there's a lot to love in failure. And I think that it's something that people run away from, especially here culturally. Our culture frowns on failure, but there are lessons in failure. I think that when you recognize that there are lessons in failure, it makes it easier to recover and move forward and do better the next time. It's when you hide from those lessons that you tend to repeat them and then end up somewhere toxic. If I were to say things I could do better, taking care of myself and just getting to a point where I'm like, okay, this isn't working and I need to do something else.
Is there something you would do differently?
No, I try not to think like that. That's too much pressure. I try not to think like that. I like where I am, and I'm happy with the steps that I've taken to make it here. I'd have loved to just end dollars the whole time. I think that would have been great. Naira has not been a joy to live in, but you know, it is what it is. And we're here because we want to change that, right? So
that makes sense. So why did you join Trapper Greek? Why was it? Did you think it was a great decision at that time? It was just like, you know what, I want to show up again and see if what I think I can do, I can do it.
So it wasn't about good or bad. It was more so about right or wrong. I don't know if that makes sense.
How do you mean?
Nigeria should be able to feed itself. A company like Thrive should not be allowed to fail. For me, it was a case of it was too important to fail. Because food security is one of those things that we as a country and continent have to get right if we want to live here in peace. Not everybody can japa, no matter how much we say we cannot all travel.
Sure.
Right? But the people we leave behind have to live in peace. So food security is important. So the right people asked me, and it seemed like a problem that I could solve. And I took time to sort of establish that, right? Because when you're joining a company at a leadership level, you don't just join if you are unsure that you can make an impact. Yeah. You have to be able to, you know, join and make sure that you're going to be able to solve the problem that the company has, at least that you can, even if you don't know for sure. And there are some steps between where you are and where you need to be, but you have to be sure. So when I took that time and it seemed possible, I agreed to do it.
What was the first thing that you did that you said, you know what, I think if I focus here or start with here, we can actually make it out of where we are right now?
Understand the problem. I am a big proponent of spending, if I have an hour to solve a problem, I will spend 55 minutes trying to figure out what the problem actually is. And I think that when you spend enough time doing that, the last 5 minutes are easy. The answers are easy. But you've really got to just figure out what the actual problem is. And this again goes back to questions, right? And learning to ask the right questions. I don't think that at any point in time, we spend enough time asking the right questions. Yeah, so, yeah.
That makes sense. Okay, so let's talk about MTN. Okay. How does it feel to be the CMO of MTN?
That's a good question. It feels good to have, because it feels like an important role.
Mm. But you've always had important roles, right?
I mean, I guess, but I don't really think about them like that. I think for me, it's, I still don't think about it like that, to be honest. Like, I feel like MTN has created critical infrastructure that has moved this continent forward. And I was excited by the opportunity to continue to do that, not just with, you know, these products, but to actually see if there are more products that can move us as a continent forward in like a big way, like in an economy altering way. Like that's like how deep and fundamental the role that MTN plays on the continent is. So that for me felt like an important mission. So it's not about me, it's really more about the gang I'm in. You know, I'm with the original tech bros. Like, if you really wanna be truthful about it, right? I mean, where would we be without our phones? And everything we're doing, this entire ecosystem we give credit for, is down to connectivity that has been provided by mobile telephony. I know it's not sexy to say it, but...
Well, it is what it is.
It is what it is.
How are you leading your team? I mean, I assume MTN is probably one of the biggest teams in Nigeria. Yeah. So that's a lot of people. How are you managing all of that?
Yeah, so I have almost 100 people in my team. But like, to be fair, like one way to think about it is I only have 5 people reporting to me directly. So, you know, I have to try and focus on them and making sure that they are the right people for those jobs so they can do what is needed. You know, when you focus on what and not who, that is stress. So I focus on making sure I have the right who, and then they take care of the they take care of the what.
And is that how you'd also describe your leadership style, if that was a question I asked?
Yeah, I would say that it as my teams and responsibilities have gotten bigger, I have moved more towards picking the right who. So I haven't sort of figured that. It's not something I figured out a long time ago and I've been doing it since. No, it's really because when you're in middle management, you're focused on doing the what.
Yeah.
And doing the what at the right level and yielding results that are better than, you know, everyone else so that you stand apart. But then as I have sort of led bigger and bigger teams, it has become more important for me to have the right who and then making sure that they are the best they can be to deliver what I need.
Mm, that makes sense. So as I hear you talk about work, one of the things that I would assume is if something that you value a lot is impact, right? When you talk about, why you joined Migo, or you talk about Tribe Greek, and even MTN, like it's about the mission for you. But what other values affect how you work and the kind of jobs that you end up taking?
So without, it's been quite incidental that I have ended up being a change agent in almost every job. I didn't set out to do that. I can't even say I necessarily like it because it's just being a change agent kind of sucks. Yeah, you know, but that's something that has happened with every role. I don't know if that answers your question. Mm. But yeah, that's been something that's been consistent.
So that you're a change agent, and so you typically will gravitate towards where you can make the most impact.
Yeah. So apparently everyone else seems to know it except me. Like I keep walking into these situations. Everybody's like, "Yeah, but yeah, that's what you do. You're a fixer." And I'm like, "Really?" But yeah, I mean, it is what it is.
That makes sense. What does the next 5 years look like for you?
So this is also another thing I try not to ask myself, right? Because if you'd asked me 5 years ago, what do you want to do? I would never have told you I would be a CMO of MTN. I am 18 months ago, if you'd asked me that question, I would never have told you, I would be the CMO of MTN. I think what I believe in, so I'm constantly curious about something. And what has happened in my career is that an opportunity has met my level of preparation at the time.
An opportunity has met your level of preparation at the time.
That's it. So whatever I know or I have prepared for or have learned or I have been curious about, an opportunity has found me right at that point. And I think that it has been easier for me to do that rather than to try to imagine 5 years out what could possibly be happening. Now, after sort of like a 20 plus year career, I can with some confidence think about, where I'm going to be in 5 years, which I hope is a private island, right? But, thinking about whoever is going to be watching this, man, take the pressure off. Don't even try to, I think, just follow your passions. And I think there are many sort of passions and topics. And, even if you like crypto now, that means that there might be a crypto job in your future. But just lean into what it is that keeps you curious and excited about that. And that's what I've done. And I've done okay.
You have done okay.
I've done okay, yeah.
I mean, so I keep thinking, just with your current role, right, being a chief marketing officer, that how has just doing engineering, business, finance, digital media, CEO, VP growth, how has it affected how you do marketing now? And is that a path that you would advise some people who want to aspire to your role? Say, hey, if you can, just don't focus on, head of marketing, head of goods. Go as wide as you can.
Yeah, so I think, honestly, I still have an engineer's mind. And I still approach problem solving with an engineer's sort of like need for structure, right? And it's just laser focus on the 1% that's missing to get 100, right? So at the end of the day, so my mandate at MTN is actually a bit big and it doesn't quite fit into marketing. So yes, I have the brands and communications team, but I'm also responsible for voice and data, which is like the entire consumer business, which is almost 90% of revenue.
Right.
So, and then I also cover, there's brands and communications, which is all the above the line, Facebook marketing. Then there's the personalized marketing, right? Which is the messages that come to your phone. I apologize in advance for everybody. I'm trying to fix that, right? So I have that as well. And I also have business intelligence. So like all the analytics, all the data in the business.
So the title is CMO, but the job isn't.
The job, you've said it better than I have. But yeah. Title CMO, but the job isn't. It's much more. So it's a pretty, the context really is, look, how can this job deliver on, or this role in its own way, deliver on what MTN needs to achieve in the next 5 years. So it's now figuring out which piece does what part. And each part has their own unique, want to play. How can I keep voice and data, right, as the primary earners in the business? How do I create other products with the data that MTN has? How does the brand need to evolve? Right? How do we source the right devices to onboard the next 100 million users to the internet? So there's definitely a lot to think about. So it's structure is extremely important to me and remains that way. But that's a product of, me being a science student to an engineering student to, management consultant and all the way through.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's a lot of responsibility.
It's a lot, yeah.
So outside of work, how do you keep yourself together now? Especially knowing that you now prioritize, like, I cannot go and keep myself, I have to prioritize rest. Tell me your passions and how you unwind.
Much of that shouldn't be said publicly. No, but I've also gotten to, I've gotten to a place where I've recognized that self-trust is part of self-love. And because I trust myself to be as brilliant as I need to be at the point when a problem is presented to me, I don't worry. And not worrying has given me so much back, so much more of my soul and energy back.
That's very interesting.
So first of all, I opt out of things like that are just needlessly stressful. So I don't worry. Tomorrow's problem is tomorrow's problem. You know what I mean? I've also had to get very comfortable with saying no. I can't be everything or to everyone or everywhere at once. You know, I have a really, really good set of friends and family who are my safe space and who are my my refuge. Right? So I hang out with my friends a lot. So yeah, I it's funny how I have the biggest job of my life, but I am at the greatest amount of peace. You know, like I have never been this busy in my entire life, but I am actually super chill. I'm very good.
That's goals.
It's a vibe.
That's the real goals.
You have to want to get there. And yeah. You have to just decide what can get you there. But let's just say, as my fellow yoga teacher friends say, it's available. It's just when you wanna go get it. So you just have to decide what you can do.
That's amazing. I have a final question, but it's 2-in-1. One is to, it's for you. It's less of a question and more for you to act on. To speak to women who want to be like you, who want to be in an amazing, ambitious career, have the job of their life, but also be at peace, you know, and just be able to create impact at different levels of their career and just kind of grow. So, especially when you're working in a male-dominated industry, speak to those women. And then also just people like Tito and Treasure, who's like 21, 23, and they're like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life yet, but I'm hoping that at some point I will figure it out. So it's like Gen Z's, right, specifically.
Well, they don't want to listen to me. Okay.
I mean, see how quiet the room is. and then women specifically. Yeah.
So this might sound like an Instagram, you know, Monday motivation.
I'm hoping it is, so that we can cut it.
You can cut it? No, but you've probably heard it before. But the truth is, what people think of you is none of your damn business. Mm. Just leave it alone. I think we get preoccupied with, oh, I'm a woman, should I be here, should I not be here? You know, just leave it. And I think everybody has imposter syndrome. Everybody has imposter syndrome. I have imposter syndrome, you know, but you just gotta be like, okay, all right, we'll have our conversation, but I'm still gonna do it. And I think if you don't have imposter syndrome, you're not thinking big enough. Mm. So if you wanna go big, you should be feeling like an imposter. So I'm very big on reframing problems into something more positive and approachable. But I think the last thing I would say maybe is your point of view is valid. It's important. But you have to also recognize, you know, that the world we live in right now has some rules, and the rules are not always in our favor. So you've got to just understand what's important. A lot of people that I meet underestimate the power of speaking properly. No, this is going to sound really, really boring. And people think you can just make up your own language and everybody has to understand it. You are responsible for making sure that what you are communicating is understood. That is your responsibility. And I see too many people on Twitter saying, oh, HR people that are looking for spelling mistakes on my CV are not focused. Okay. No, I'm serious. We have to just recognize that this world is bound by certain rules of engagement. And at some point, you will be able to redefine those rules. But you have to first know them. You have to first learn to win under those circumstances. Then you can change the rules when you have that kind of leverage. So I would say what I'm saying right now applies to both men, but especially to women, right? So when I let me break the last part down, especially. I was just saying to somebody this morning that having spent the last, 20 plus years, 25 years of my career, just sort of pushing against all the things that women are not supposed to do, I now know how to get through them and wield them to my advantage. So like I tell my team, who often try to win arguments just with sheer conversation, and I'm like, use data. There's really no point walking into a room and saying, I know, because somebody's going to check you. If you're a woman, it's going to be a man. If you're older, it's going to be a Gen Z. If you're a Gen Z, it's going to be an older person. The diversity in the workplace now demands an objective arbiter of your arguments. Use data. Right? So even me as a leader, I can't just get up and tell somebody, that reports to me, you do this, right? I actually don't do it. I can, but I don't, right? And I teach them how to go and see the point themselves and help them make up their mind. You know what that also does? That also gives me ease. Do you understand? Because arguments can be very stressful. You know, so with women, when everybody's saying women don't do this, women don't do that, you know, I didn't realize I was the first female CMO at MTN. Nigeria, when they told me, I was like, okay.
It's okay.
No, I mean, like, I can't get caught up in stuff like that. But there are, you start to quickly see the assumptions that people make about you. But like I said, assumptions aren't just made about women. They're made about everybody.
Yeah.
If you sound different, if you look different, if your accent is different, all those assumptions that people make affect you. You know, discrimination is not a... It doesn't have one path. I've seen people with tribal marks get discriminated. I've seen devout Muslims, you know, not get promoted as much because they don't fit into the typical picture of an alpha personality, which is what you look out for leadership. So, you know, like I said, understand the rules and then bend them to your will when you understand them deeply.
That's amazing. It feels like I did more of a masterclass than an interview. And I don't get this a lot from a lot of interviews, but as you were rounding up, I was like, I know that was the reason I went to speak to Adia. Like, I was like, I want to, because I know you're a dynamite, but I did not know until now that I really know. It's been a pleasure. I think I've learned a lot even from the beginning, like when you're talking about your childhood and just confident. And obviously that's your experience. But to me, it was like, oh yes, like, there's a vibe from just showing up confidently and saying, doesn't matter who is in the room, but I will show up just confident in myself and do the work, right? So not entering rooms with a certain bias of just enter and then figure it out. And then you just talking about like getting your first role and going to MBA and then coming to Nigeria and saying, oh, don't look for a job just because you're looking for a job. Look for where they will place value on your skills. And that kind of changes the conversation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those things are more negotiations and conversation than, oh, I'm applying. And, interview process. I was like, yeah, that really stalks. And then again, when you talked about every opportunity has come based on your level of preparedness. And I'm like, ha. I was saying to myself, like, that's something I don't want to forget, because sometimes we just want to, you know, just keep working and find the next opportunity. But really, opportunities and the right ones, they come based on where we are in life and how prepared we are. Mm-hmm. And being able to then choose the right one and then choose it. See, if I go, I'll do another 10 minutes of all the things that I learned from just listening to your story.
You have a great memory, though. I don't even remember what I said.
Yeah, because I'm listening. Like, I'm not just asking you questions. Yeah, I'm really listening and just, like, really picking out stuff. And so my point is, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having this conversation with me. And thank you for just sharing openly and, you know, taking me through your masterclass. I will come and pay for mentorship because I need to dive in more. But really, thank you so much. Do you have any last words?
No. Listen, I've said enough words, right?
You have said a lot. So again, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast to the end. I hope you really enjoy this episode. I hope that you have been inspired or motivated to get better in your careers, in your businesses, in your life. I hope this, you enjoyed it. If you did, please make sure you subscribe to the videos on my YouTube channel at PC Timmy, or just search for Founders Connect and you'll find the playlist, and then subscribe to the channel. Also, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you are listening to it. Leave a rating also so more people can find it, and also talk about the episode that you listen to. Hashtag Founders Connect across social media. Hey, I'll see you in the next episode. Peace out.